Apple's new credit card has been hit with charges of sexism, and now complaints are coming from the company's co-founder. Steve Wozniak says he got 10 times the credit limit his wife received, even though they do not hold separate assets or bank or credit accounts. The criticism behind the iPhone maker's card began Thursday when entrepreneur David Heinemeier Hansson tweeted that the card gave him 20 times more credit than his wife had received.
Netflix has a new tough critic, the Sovereign Republic of Poland. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki filed a complaint this week asking the U.S. streaming service to make changes to its documentary series, The Devil Next Door, about a Nazi death camp guard who moved to the United States. At issue is a map used in the documentary showing Nazi death camps inside the borders of modern Poland, but Morawiecki says the map implies that Poland existed at the time as an independent nation and thus could share responsibility for the Holocaust.
Sudan says it needs up to $5 billion in foreign aid to avert economic collapse and launch reforms. This follows months of protests over price hikes for fuel and bread, which triggered the uprising that led to the ouster of veteran ruler Omar al-Bashir. Finance Minister Ibrahim al-Badawi told Reuters the country has only enough foreign currency reserves to fund imports for a few weeks.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's November the 12th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. Another business day getting underway here. We've got lots going on in the world of business that we'll try to get to you this morning. An update on the markets. If you had yesterday off for a holiday, back at it today. The bond market will be back open today. It was closed yesterday, so those investors will be getting back to work today. On the program today, on The Opening Bell, we're going to focus in on beer in the first segment this morning. Peter Frost, the managing editor of Behind the Beer at Miller Coors, will join us. Lots going on in the world of beer this morning, and Peter will join us to share some of that with us. A little bit later in the program, Dr. Pamela Newkirk, a professor at NYU and author of Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. And that'll be at about 5:48 this morning here on The Opening Bell. So stay tuned. We've got a good show for you this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with futures pointing toward an opening gain on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are up about 28 points, just fractionally. NASDAQ futures up nearly a quarter of a percent, up about 15 points. S&P futures are up a fraction as well. As we look around the rest of the world, markets in Europe are generally in the green. In London, up by nearly a third. In Germany, up by nearly a half a percent. In France, up by nearly a third as well. The CAC up about 17 points this morning. Trading day coming to an end in Asia. In Japan, up nearly 188 points on the Nikkei, up nearly three quarters of a percent. In Hong Kong, up nearly 138 points, up about a half a percent. In China, up about 4 points, just fractionally higher this morning in China. And also this morning, oil is trading at $57.18 a barrel, up about 32 cents. A couple of big stories making the news this morning. Business news on the ticker. More than three dozen Southwest Airlines planes are still in service after aviation regulators considered grounding them last month. Wall Street Journal is reporting the carrier was unable to verify the 38 aircraft met mandatory safety standards. Congressional investigators and federal regulators are looking at the airline's purchase of foreign planes. Southwest did not provide proof that the 737s received proper maintenance and repairs while they were used outside of the U.S. An inspection of each plane is expected to be done by the end of January. The Twitter is lighting up with the hashtag Boycott Uber today after the CEO of the company called the murder of Washington Post journalist Khashoggi a mistake. Dari Khashoggi made the comments in an interview that aired this weekend. Now he's apologizing. He's tweeted that there's no forgiving what happened to the journalist who was killed by the Saudi government, which is Uber's biggest investor. Khashoggi had added he said something in the moment that he does not believe. And Burger King is rolling out a vegetarian burger in markets across Europe while expanding its meatless options here in the States. Chain says the Rebel Whopper will be available in more than 2,400 restaurants today. In the U.S., the chain is growing its Impossible Burger line, with testing at 180 restaurants in Milwaukee, Cedar Rapids, Augusta, Cincinnati, and Buffalo over, and now available at most stores in the United States. Peter Frost is with us this morning from Miller Coors. Peter is the managing editor of Behind the Beer there. Peter, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Thanks for having me back, Steve. Good to see you.
It's good to see you as well. How's beer treating you?
Beer is going well.
Yeah, there's some news that we wanted to talk to you about today. And right off the top, I think if people are following what's happening in the beer world, Miller Coors is moving its headquarters, moving some people around. What's happening?
It is. So in late October, our new CEO of Molson Coors, Gavin Hattersley, announced a complete sort of a sweeping reorganization of the company. It's a revitalization plan. What that does is it moves our corporate headquarters from Denver to Chicago and also moves more of our support functions into Milwaukee. So it's a pretty significant change for the company. We're moving from four major business units down to two. So it's the whole goal here is to free up more cash to plow back into the business because it's changing quickly and we need to act fast. And it also, you know, will result in a, you know, just allows us to move quicker. Mm-hmm.
Will there be changes? Consumers will consumers notice changes, and will there be behind the scenes changes?
There will be a lot of behind-the-scenes changes. I don't know if consumers will notice so much. I mean, I guess I hope the company hopes that consumers will notice that we're coming out with new products mm-hmm. quicker and we're addressing their needs quicker. That means moving into adjacencies beyond beer. So that's one of the big things that I think consumers will see. But it's not like Miller Lite's going away or we're going to stop investing behind Coors Light, our biggest brand. Mm-hmm. All their favorites are still going to be there. It's just that hopefully we're going to give them some new options.
Right. And the name, there's an official name change as well.
There is, yeah. So it was Molson Coors Brewing Company, which owned Miller Coors. Miller Coors was the U.S. subsidiary. It's a long story how we got here.
Yeah.
But they're phasing out the Miller Coors name, and we're just going to be Molson Coors Beverage Company now. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer brewing. It's beverage. And what Gavin Hattersley has said is that's a very intentional move on the company's behalf to signal to the market that we're not just about beer anymore.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that in our conversation today because there's a couple of different things, whether you talk about hard seltzer or even marijuana, cannabis-infused drinks, but we'll get into that. I wanted to start our conversation this morning because it's rare to have some of this insight, and I think this is fascinating. When I go into a convenience store, I'd go in and get my stuff and come out, and I don't think there's any science to it at all. But there is a science, and well, let's focus on the beverage part of this, how convenience stores not only stock what the kinds of beers and liquors that they're selling, but how long it's kept on the shelves. I mean, talk to us a little bit about all the science that goes into marketing and convenience store layout.
Sure. Well, every class of trade is a little bit different. And C-stores, people come in, like you said, like you. They go in, they go out. They know what they're going to get before they go in the store. They expect to see it. If they don't see it, they walk out, right? So it's really interesting. In convenience stores, a lot of people might not know this, but it's the largest channel for beer. So some 30% of beer sales are done through convenience stores. So it's a huge channel for us. So it's naturally something that our sales teams look at, and they try to, you know, they try to help our distributor network and our retail network understand better how consumers act in these stores and what things they need. And most consumers are buying smaller packs of beer. So singles are huge. 63% of sales out of convenience stores are singles, six packs, but also 12 packs. So it's different by occasion. If you're coming home from work, you want a couple of beers, you might buy a couple singles. If you're going to a friend's house for dinner, you might bring a six pack of craft beer. Or if you're going to a tailgate or something like that, you might want a 12 pack. So it's tough because convenience stores are small, yet you want to make sure they have the right assortment for the occasions that people are looking for, are looking to consume their beverage in.
How involved is a company like yours in making sure that that layout stays beneficial to your company?
Well, I think all big beer companies are somewhat involved. It's category management is what mm-hmm. we call it. It's a big focus for the company. So we try to be very involved. We try to be very helpful, but there's only so much we can do, right? Mm-hmm. First off, we're not selling directly into the convenience stores. We go through a distributor network. So we're educating those people on how we think the layout should look. And then, of course, you know, with our blog, for example, we're trying to get our, you know, I hate this word, but thought leadership out there as right. to what the best way is to stock those stores.
Let's talk about the number of times people visit a convenience store versus going to a grocery store, because, you know, a big box store, the big liquor stores, even the big grocery stores carry all of the stuff we're talking about, but people tend to go more to the convenience store.
They do. It's crazy. So the average beer shopper visits convenience stores 0.1 times per week, which is bananas to me.
3.1.
So like 2.2 kids, which I think is fascinating. And I think I don't know if it's I think it's more about like being in this urban bubble. But like in rural parts of America or in places where people drive more often, I think that's a bigger trend. But, you know, the average C-store shopper is in there 2.5 times a week. And so the beer shopper is there more often. And singles buyers, so people who are going in after work and buying, you know, a 24-ounce whatever, Miller Lite or Coors Light or what have you, they go up to 20 times per month to a convenience store to buy beer, which is crazy. So it's you have to make sure you got enough stock. You got to make sure the beer is cold. Those are the big things.
And the stock is the important thing. The figures on how much turnover there is in terms of, because if you have all those people coming that many times for beer, you better make sure you have plenty of beer.
Right. And especially because they all come around the same time, right? Like a big percentage of beer shoppers are coming in between 3 and 8 p.m.
Yeah.
So you got to have a lot of stock ready to rotate in to those shelves, and you've got to have it cold, like I said. So that's something that C-stores really need to get down. You don't want to have empty shelves because, like I said earlier, if I go in looking for a Coors Light and I can't find it, I'm going to go somewhere else.
So I guess the nightmare scenario would be your company hearing convenience stores want to renovate and move beer from one location to another in the store, or maybe even put some one of these other specialty drinks in place of beer. That probably would be a no-no, wouldn't it?
Well, for us, yeah. I mean, I guess one of the big things is in C-stores these days, you'll see a lot more craft selection, which they have to do. They've got to have craft in there to bring people in. There's a lot more hard seltzer because hard seltzer is on fire, which they have to do. But what we're trying to counsel retailers not to do is to get rid of premium lights like Miller Lite, Coors Light, even Bud Light, or economy beers like Keystone Light, Busch Light, things like that, because those still account for the largest percentage of transactions. So people are still looking for those beers. And, you know, if you remove them to get more craft or selection, and you do so at your own peril, I guess.
Yeah, the premium figure, I was kind of going through some of my notes here to find this. The not only do people go in to buy beer, and it's the most, but the premium beers, that's what people are buying the most of.
Yeah, so we classify premium beers as Miller Lite, Coors Light, Bud Light, even like Michelob Ultra. That's where all the volume is. I know all the talk and the cultural zeitgeist is now focused on craft and seltzers, but the volume in this industry is still in those premium lights.
Talk to us about the hard seltzer numbers here. I've seen some numbers where you've had more than 100, even in some cases 200% growth of hard seltzers. That's really taken off, hasn't it?
It's a rocket.
Yeah.
It's a cultural phenomenon. It's crazy. And I mean, when we talk about hard seltzer, there are a lot of brands here, but we're really talking about White Claw, frankly. White Claw that's owned by Constellation Brands here in Chicago, one of our competitors, but they're just killing it. And what White Claw has become this, like I said, a cultural phenomenon. It's up, the segment's up 200% over the past 52 weeks, and it continues to grow. We thought that, you know, once we get into fall from summer, we might start to see this slow down. We might see some seasonality, and we're not seeing it. And so you're seeing a lot more action there. Anheuser-Busch just announced that Bud Light is coming out with a seltzer, Bud Light seltzer. Mm-hmm. They've got a natural light seltzer. They've got another higher-end seltzer. And so, I mean, you're going to see some action from Miller Coors on this as well. We've got a seltzer play called Henry's Hard Sparkling Water. And I think you'll continue to see us being active here because that is where all the hype is.
Is there a battle shaping up for shelf space, though?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There always is a battle for shelf space. So, I mean, Miller Coors is trying to protect the shelf space for its fastest moving and biggest selling brands like Coors Light and Miller Lite, High Life, Coors Banquet, Keystone Light. But yeah, I mean, everyone's fighting for shelf space on seltzers and in FMBs, flavored malt beverages, which is, you know, where that falls.
You know, one of the other things that I want to talk to you about while you're here today is this, the non-alcoholic beer craze. I thought that would be just a trend that would be a flash and go away, but we've seen a couple of new introductions into this. I know the Budweiser has something new called Budweiser Zero coming out. You guys are doing something as well. Talk to us about this sector of your business.
Yeah, this has been going on in Europe and Canada. It's been a decades long trend, I suppose, in Europe and Canada. You're seeing a lot of people moving into lower alcohol or no alcohol beverages. And in the U.S. now, you're starting to see, especially with the older Gen Z cohort, which is these 21 to 25 year olds, they're drinking less. And there's this whole like sober curious movement going on. There's dry January. There's sober September. You're seeing this whole class of young adults who are just not into alcohol as much as our generation was. And so everyone's sort of starting to, most of the big brewers are starting to move in that direction to try to meet these needs. So we're coming out with Coors Edge, which we launched in Canada earlier this year. Now it's coming into the U.S. It's a non-alc beer. Bud Zero is there, Heineken 0.0. And I mean, it's not even just non-alc beer that you're seeing happening here. Non-alc beer is up 8%. So it's outpacing the beer industry as a whole, but it's still tiny in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We think there's a lot more room to grow there. But it's not just in beer. There are other drinks like kombucha, which is on fire. There are all these like value-added drinks or whatever. Like before, we're talking about taking things out, right? Everyone's talking about like we have fewer calories and carbs. But now consumers want things like antioxidants in their drinks, yeah. And they want probiotics. So you're seeing all of that happening in non-alc, and you might start to see some of that move into alcohol as well.
Yeah, 41. Back to the Coors Edge. 41 calories, 8 grams of carbohydrates.
Yeah,
less than a 0.5% by alcohol by volume. What is that? What does it taste like?
It tastes like beer.
Yeah.
It tastes like. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to explain. It does taste like beer, but it doesn't taste like you're having a Coors banquet. Mm-hmm. To me, I think it's right. You know, it's for someone who wants the taste of beer but doesn't want the alcohol.
Right.
It's a pretty good. Pretty good option.
Or somebody who doesn't want the calories either, who's trying to watch their waist. And then there's the whole marijuana question. January 1st is the big date here in Illinois with recreational marijuana. How is that impacting our beverages?
So in Canada, it's legal already. So we have a partnership. Molson Coors has a partnership with Truss in Canada. It's a marijuana company there, or excuse me, a cannabis company there. And we are partnering with them to make non-alcoholic cannabis beverages. We see that as a big part of the future. And you're seeing it in the U.S., obviously. It's going state by state. First, it was medical marijuana. Now it's recreational. And you're sort of seeing it roll across the country. So, you know, we're a big beer company. Obviously, this is a very important space for us to be looking at because sometimes, marijuana might be a substitute for alcohol. So I don't know if we're going to play here until we see federal legalization. But mm-hmm. We're certainly looking at this hard in Canada, and I think we're doing that for a reason.
My question on that is, when we go out and have a beer, we say we're going to go out and maybe get drunk. If it's a cannabis drink, how do we describe that? We're going to go out and drink till we get high? Or
well,
what?
I don't know. See,
what's the
please celebrate responsibly.
Yeah.
First off.
Yeah, right.
with cannabis drinks, I don't know. I mean, there are different ways to use cannabis, right? Some of it is for the THC, which, as you mentioned, is sort of that, I guess people describe it as getting high. Mm. And there's also the CBD element of this, which is huge. And that's more of a, I don't know if I can say medical or health
sort of
related.
Chilling
but
out a little bit.
Yeah, if you got a sore back or sore knees, sometimes that's the right thing to do. Or if you got a headache, sometimes people are using, more and more people are using CBD. You're seeing it in lotions. I mean, it's become this phenomenon.
Well, Peter, it's always good chatting with you. Thanks for coming in and sharing your news from Beer World with us today.
Always my pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Peter Frost with Molson Coors. He's also the managing editor behind the Beer blog. You can find it at MolsonCoors.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. On the program today, coming up, Dr. Pamela Newkirk from NYU. She's written a new book called Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. We'll get to that at about 5:48 this morning. We'll check in with Orion momentarily. From the business ticker this morning, news, small businesses are continuing to be optimistic. The Small Business Optimism Index is out for October. Shows advances in 8 of the measure's 10 components. Job creation, inventory, investment, and capital spending led the month's gains. Plans to invest were strong in agriculture, wholesale trades, manufacturers, and transportation. The New York financials, New York's financial regulator is opening up an investigation over the algorithms for Apple's new credit card over claims of gender bias. This comes after a tech entrepreneur David Heinemeier Hansen said Apple's card gave him a much higher credit limit than his wife received.
It seemed very discriminatory that I would get 20 times the credit limit, even though our stats were the same.
The difference in credit limits forced David, despite his wife having a better credit score than him and the couple's filing jointly, to get that larger credit limit. A spokesperson for Linda Lacewell, the superintendent of the New York Department of Financial Services, says the investigation is to ensure every Apple credit card user is treated equally regardless of sex. Goldman Sachs also has launched an investigation into some of this. This morning, we're also seeing a number of new notes about economic data from the auto industry. Nissan reporting a 70% slump in quarterly profits. Japan's number two automaker said that today its profit for the July to September quarter was just under $275 million. Companies with that compares rather with a $930 million profit a year ago. As a result, Nissan is cutting its full-year outlook to an 11-year low. Let's get an update now on agriculture and commodities, and here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning. No harvest progress reports to report this morning because some of the USDA offices were closed for Veterans Day yesterday. And so those harvest progress reports will be out this afternoon. But there was a lot of selling of grain at the Chicago Board of Trade. Most active corn contract down 4 cents a bushel. The December wheat down 4.5 cents a bushel. And soybeans were down 14 cents a bushel. Brokers at the Board of Trade estimated that funds sold 2,500 contracts of corn, 1,000 contracts of wheat, and 4,500 contracts of soybeans. And the Department of Agriculture did report that exporters sold 136,000 metric tons of U.S. soybeans to China for delivery during the current marketing year. Livestock futures for the day yesterday, live cattle continued the rally. Beef prices have increased recently thanks to firm demand helping push up margins for processing companies such as Tyson Foods and JBS USA. February live cattle touched their highest price since April 23rd before finishing up 65 cents a hundredweight. January feeder cattle set their highest price since May 10th. Well, today is the beginning day of the annual convention of the National Association of Farm Broadcasters. So I'll be joining fellow radio TV broadcasters of agricultural news from around the country. That convention goes through Saturday. And on Thursday night, we will honor Max Armstrong. He'll be inducted into the Farm Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Have a great day. That's Ag Biz for this morning. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba reported nearly $70 billion in sales yesterday on Singles Day, an annual marketing event that's the world's busiest online shopping day. The day was a temporary relief to retailers that faced fading demands, as Chinese consumers tighten their belts, anxious over slowing economic growth and the tariff war with Washington. University students created Singles Day in the 1990s as an alternative to Valentine's Day for people without romantic partners. Alibaba adopted this as a marketing tool about a decade ago. Creators picked November 11th because the date is written with four singles, 11, 11, 1, 1, 1, 1. Companies are spending billions of dollars a year on diversity efforts. So where are the results? How is this even measured? Joining us this morning, Dr. Pamela Newkirk, who is a professor of journalism at NYU, New York University, and author of Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Dr. Newkirk, good morning. Welcome to WGN.
Good morning, and you can call me Pamela.
Pamela, thank you. It's nice having you on this morning. I mentioned in the opening that companies are spending billions on diversity. Most companies, it seems, now have a diversity officer at the very least. Some have diversity czars.
Right.
Talk to us a little bit about first of all, why all of that has happened, and then how do we measure whether or not it's having any impact?
Well, first we can look at the rise in the number of diversity czars, diversity consultants, diversity conferences. So we know from a number of different metrics that their numbers are growing. But we also see that the needle is not really moving when you look at the percentage of underrepresented minorities in particular in pretty much every influential field, whether we're looking at journalism or we're looking at higher education or if we're looking at even Hollywood, the percentage of directors and the executives who greenlight projects, those numbers have not really changed in decades. And yet there's this rhetoric around diversity and as you noted, the billions of dollars that are spent each year, and yet the numbers are pretty much stagnant. And in some respects are in retreat. We have fewer African-American Fortune 500 CEOs today than we had 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it feels like that this is really, and I don't want to say that it happens in all companies, but you have a situation where a company gets in trouble, where there's a problem.
Exactly.
And I know you've listed a couple in your latest piece in Time.com on Time.com. But they hire the czar. They get in trouble. They hire a czar to try to turn it around. And it feels like that's the last we hear about what happens at that company, how the impact of that czar or diversity officer has really changed what goes on at that company.
Precisely. And when we go back to those companies, what we see is that diversity czars are mainly treated as, public relations solutions to public problems, rather than people who can change the institutional culture and really try to address the acute underrepresentation of people of color in many of these workplaces.
A 2019 survey of nearly 234 companies in the S&P 500 showed that 63% mm-hmm. of them had some diversity professionals. And I know you write that the number of postings for those kinds of jobs is up more than 30% over 2 years. So it's a trend that's not really ending.
Right. No, it's definitely growing. I mean, you can just see the growth and just the number of stories about diversity and hiring. And, you know, we've seen in recent years a number of companies and institutions hire their first diversity czars, usually in response to some kind of public scandal. And as I say, the rise in these positions is not substantially increasing a rise in diversity.
So what's the answer here? A lot of these are publicly traded companies. Is it something that has to change institutionally and perhaps is led by investors?
Well, you know, what I think is there may in fact be some goodwill around this issue in some of these companies. But what I'm questioning is if you keep doing the same thing and you keep getting the same results, perhaps you should change your strategy. And if you're going to spend as like Google spends more than $100 million a year on diversity initiatives, and their numbers have barely moved in years, for I think African Americans are somewhere between 2-3%, and Latinos are a little bit more than that. And every year they're spending this money, and perhaps they could spend that money on other kinds of initiatives that really invest in the pipeline, invest in other ways to increase diversity other than just like having these czars and these consultants and, you know, this huge apparatus of diversity that is doing little to change anything. And you cited a study that came out this year looking at diversity czars in many of these institutions, and they were asked, you know, if they had the resources to do their job. Most of them said they didn't have the resources. I think it was something like 65% didn't even have access to the institutional metrics to even be able to look at the problem and be able to make the kind of interventions that are necessary. So if you're going to have these people in your offices, you have to give them a way to actually make a change.
Yeah, and it feels like it's a shame, a missed opportunity in the era of Me Too and Black Lives Matter and other movements, social media movements or other movements, social movements, that this is a missed opportunity to really make a difference.
Exactly. It really is. And it has to, you know, companies have to stop treating this as just a feel-good thing that you talk about diversity and you claim that, you know, this is, you know, your company is fully behind it, and really see it as not just a social justice movement and a effort to really, you know, live up to the ideals of our country, of the civil rights movement, but, you know, a way to actually improve their workplaces, to have greater innovation, to have new ideas, to you know, expand the worldview of these places. And you know, study after study shows that diversity increases innovation and it increases even the bottom line.
Yeah, I feel like also my profession's not doing a good enough job to shine light on some of this. Perhaps more news coverage of some of these companies, and maybe even more laws. Maybe a law is needed. Maybe Congress needs to get involved.
Well, I mean, since the 1960s, we've had many laws. We've had, you know, we have equal opportunity laws. We have laws that forbid discrimination in employment and you know, housing. But that laws alone will not change this. This is a time for soul searching and really thinking about the society that we want to live in.
Dr. Newkirk, we appreciate you being on with us this morning. We'll go out and get your book and read it, and please come back and join us sometime.
Thank you. Anytime.
Dr. Pamela Newkirk, professor at NYU and author of Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business, which is available now. On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Tuesday, November 12th, the Small Business Optimism Index for October is out today. Small business analysts expect to see a rise in the index that's been running at or near historic highs. Also today, the Red Book is due. We'll also hear from a number of Fed speakers, Patrick Harker, Neil Kashkari, Richard Clarida, on monetary policy and also interest rates. Earnings reports from Tyson Foods and CBS are out before the opening bell. Smile Direct Club will report quarterly earnings after the close. So just a few things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, November the 12th.